Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Bookworm. It's my turn again, Maurice Newman, and this week it's all about the thrillers. Millions upon millions of us read thrillers. Next time you're passing through an airport or a train station, have a quick look at the bookstall. You'll see the names, the same names across Europe and North America in every airport and train station you go to. Harris, Cornwell, James, Grisham, Patterson, King, Christie, and on and on. Just the same list of names, the huge sellers. But what are thrillers, and why do we love them so much? I'm going to be boring on about this for the next hour or so, and giving later on, hopefully, some very valuable tips for anyone that's considering writing a thriller, because it's really easy. Or maybe it's not. But either way, you'll have some valuable information if you're thinking of knocking out a few million, billion sellers. But before we get into all that, I'm going to play a little bit of music to set the mood for this week's show. And all the music this week will be coming from Paris in the 1930s and 20s. And maybe before, maybe after, but around that period. It's cafe music of the time, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. And here's the first one. This is Tino Rossi with Vieni Vieni, which was the most popular song of its day. So we'll have a listen to that, and then we'll move on to some deep philosophical and literary chit-chat.
Ma canzone ce soir dans la nuit si troublante te dira mon espoir. Vieni, 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 tu sei bella, 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 accanto a me. Vieni, 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 tu sei bella, 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 accanto a me. Paola, sei la più bella, mia rondinella, nel mio cuore. Ah, dans les bois d'Ajaccio, j'avais cueilli dimanche sur ta lèvre un bagio. Vieni, 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 tu sei bella, 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 accanto a me. Vieni, 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 tu sei bella, 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 accanto a me. Paola, sei la più bella, mia rondinella, nel mio cuore. Oh, 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 oh. Bella, 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 canta a me. Vieni, 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 tu sei bella, 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 canta a me. Oh, oh, sei la più bella, mia rondinella, nel mio cuore. Una canzone d'amore.
Wasn't that fantastic? The great Chuck Berry once said that the true sign of a great pop song is one that you simply have to, gotta hear again that day as soon as possible. And I think anybody who heard that song will want to hear it again very quickly as soon as possible. A great song, Tino Rossi, Vieni Vieni. Lovely. From 1934. an old pop song. Still, anyway, to get back to the subject, what is a thriller? Discussions of this type can get very complicated. Who do you include? Who don't you include? What is a thriller? What isn't a thriller? What's a thriller? What's a horror story? But to keep things easier here, I'm going to narrow the field down a little bit. I'm just going to talk about detective novels. And some people may say they're not thrillers, but I'm saying they are. In the detective novel, the emphasis is on method, motive, and the pursuit of clues. There may be incidents and accidents and action along the way, and there should always be considerable suspense involved. But essentially, those things are always secondary to the procedure of the investigation. We want to find out who did it. Thrillers have changed a bit over the years, as the world has, I mean, but some things always stay the same. And in thrillers, detective stories, atmosphere, locale, adventure, and all the logistics of the story may play a role, even a major role in the story. But they're still secondary to that central problem, the solving of the crime. Who done it? That's what we want to know. The first... If you like, the first detective story is Edgar Allan Poe's Murder in the Rue Morgue. That was published in 1841. There have been a lot of detective stories since then, and by a lot of writers. But most of them still follow the pattern that Poe established in the Rue Morgue story 175 years ago. And a little spoiler alert here for anyone who's missed out on reading this. The monkey did it. Now, I'm sorry if that's ruined it for you, but let's face it, if you haven't read it by now, there's not much chance that you're going to, really. Anyway, going forward, as I said, fashions changed. In 1886, now that's almost half a century later, 50 years later, Sherlock Holmes appears. In the first Sherlock Holmes story is A Study in Scarlet. And Holmes's creator, Arthur Conan Doyle, he sets a sort of an agenda. He creates a template, if you like, that still kind of works today. So in Holmes, we get this hero that becomes familiar to us as we go through all his adventures over the years. But he becomes a pal, if you like. We know him. He's quirky, he's individualistic, and he's invincibly clever. And he can see through people in an instant, right, straight away. If you walk into a room where he sits smoking his pipe, he'll know in seconds how much money you earn, how many children you've got, where you like to go on holiday, what you had for breakfast and where, and whether your wife or husband still loves you. I'm going to give you now a reading from The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, in which Holmes sort of turns his intellect towards a hat. He just gets a hat, and this is the opening clue. The story's being narrated by Dr. Watson. So I'm going to here's the reading, and see what you make of it. I'll be with you again in a moment. Arthur Conan Doyle, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, starring Sherlock Holmes. I'd called upon my friend Sherlock Holmes upon the second morning after Christmas, with the intention of wishing him the compliments of the season. He was lounging upon the sofa in a purple dressing gown, a pipe rack within his reach upon the right, and a pile of crumpled morning papers, evidently newly studied, near at hand. Beside the couch was a wooden chair, and on the angle of the back hung a very seedy and disreputable hard felt hat, much the worse for wear, and cracked in several places. A lens and a forceps lying upon the seat of the chair suggested that the hat had been suspended in this manner for the purpose of examination. "You are engaged," said I. "Perhaps I interrupt you." "Not at all. I am glad to have a friend with whom I can discuss my results. The matter is a perfectly trivial one." He jerked his thumb in the direction of the old hat. "But there are points in connection with it which are not entirely devoid of interest, and even of instruction." I seated myself in his armchair and warmed my hands before his crackling fire, for a sharp frost had set in, and the windows were thick with the ice crystals. "I suppose," I remarked, "that, homely as it looks, this thing has some deadly story linked to it, and that is the clue which will guide you in the solution of some mystery and the punishment of some crime." "No, no, no crime," said Sherlock Holmes, laughing. "Only one of those whimsical little incidents which will happen when you have 4 million human beings all jostling each other within the space of a few square miles. You know Peterson, the commissionaire?"
"Yes."
"It is to him that this trophy belongs."
"It is his hat?"
"No, no, he found it. Its owner is unknown. I beg that you will look upon it not as a battered billycock, but as an intellectual problem. The facts are these.
About 4 o'clock on Christmas morning, Peterson, who, as you know, is a very honest fellow, was returning from some small jollification and making his way homeward down Tottenham Court Road. In front of him he saw, in the gaslight, a tallish man, walking with a slight stagger and carrying a white goose slung over his shoulder. As he reached the corner of Goodge Street, a row broke out between this stranger and a little knot of roughs. One of the latter knocked off the man's hat, on which he raised his stick to defend himself, and swinging it over his head, smashed the shop window behind him. Peterson rushed forward to protect the stranger from his assailants, but the man was shocked at having broken the window, and seeing an official-looking person in uniform rushing towards him, dropped the goose, took to his heels, and vanished amid the labyrinth of small streets which lie at the back of Tottenham Court Road. The roughs had also fled, so Peterson was left in possession of the field of battle, and also the spoils of victory in the shape of this battered hat and a most unimpeachable Christmas goose, which surely he restored to their owner. My dear fellow, there lies the problem. It's true that "For Mrs. Henry Baker" was printed upon the small card which was tied to the bird's leg, and it's also true that the initials HB are legible upon the lining of the hat. But there are some thousands of Bakers and hundreds of Henry Bakers in this city. It's not easy to restore lost property to any one of them. What did Peterson do then? He brought round both hat and goose to me on Christmas morning, knowing that even the smallest problems are of interest to me. The goose we retained until this morning, when there were signs that, in spite of the slight frost, it would be well it should be eaten without delay. Its finder has carried it off to fulfil the ultimate destiny of a goose, while I continue to retain the hat of the unknown gentleman who lost his Christmas dinner. What clue could you have to his identity? Only as much as we can deduce. From his hat? Precisely. But you're joking. What can you gather from this old battered felt hat? He picked it up and gazed at it in the peculiar, introspective fashion which was characteristic of him. It's perhaps less suggestive than it might have been, he said, and yet there are few inferences which are very distinct, and a few others which represent at least a strong balance of probability. The man was highly intellectual, and of course it's obvious upon the face of it that he was also fairly well-to-do, and well-to-do within the last 3 years, although he has now fallen upon evil days. He had foresight, but has less now than formerly, pointing to a moral retrogression which, when taken with the decline of his fortunes, seems to indicate some evil influence, probably drink, at work upon him. This may account also for the obvious fact that his wife has ceased to love him. That's pretty good, isn't it? Could you do that? I'll give you one of me runners and you can give it a smell and see if you can deduce how much I earn a week from that, and whether I enjoy a drink at the weekend or not. While you figure out or try to have a little practice and see if you can do it on other people, I'm just going to play the next record for you. This one's by Lucien Delisle, and forgive me pronunciation if you are a French speaker, but it's Sur le Quai de Vieux Paris. And it's from 1939. I'm certain, confident that you're going to enjoy this.
Quand doucement tu te penches en murmurant ces dimanches, si nous allions en banlieue faire un tour sous le ciel bleu des beaux jours. Mille projets nous attirent et dans un même sourire nous refaisons le trajet simple et doux de nos premiers rendez-vous sur les quais du vieux Paris. Le long de la Seine, le bonheur sourit. Sur les quais du vieux Paris, l'amour se promène en cherchant un nid. Vieux bouquiniste, belle fleuriste, comment vous aime, vivant poème. Sur les quais du vieux Paris, de l'amour bohème, c'est le paradis. Tous les vieux ponts nous connaissent, témoins de folles promesses, qu'au fil de l'eau leur écho va compter aux gais moineaux effrontés. Et dans tes bras qui m'enchaînent, en écoutant les sirènes, voulait se battre éperdu de bonheur, mon cœur auprès de ton cœur. Sur les quais du vieux Paris, le long de la Seine, le bonheur sourit. Sur les quais du vieux Paris, l'amour se promène en cherchant un nid. Vieux bouquiniste, belle fleuriste, comme on vous aime, vivant poème. Sur les quais du vieux Paris, de l'amour bohème, c'est le paradis. Sur les quais du vieux Paris, de l'amour bohème, c'est le paradis.
I can't stand it. I'm just going to go and have to move to Paris. I'm going to have to move to Paris in the 1930s, which is going to be difficult, but I'm going for it. And nobody's going to stop me. Don't you try and stop me. Anyway, back to detectives. We've heard Sherlock Holmes now and that little bit. And you can tell from the language alone that he's of the Victorian era. It's kind of long, drawn out, and not quite so pacey as we like now in the 21st century. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's move forward from Sherlock to the 20th century. And one of the great names in detective fiction, of course, Agatha Christie. And she's still a big name, but her brand of country house murder mysteries was massively popular from about 1927 up to the present day, really, but it peaked in the 30s. And again, here we have this idea of the familiar character that becomes a sort of friendly, dependable face in a mysterious world. And Christie didn't muck about when it came to creating familiar characters. Miss Marple, Hercule Poirot, Tommy and Tuppence, and there were others. And all of Agatha Christie's characters have this great individuality and are very familiar to readers, even to this day, almost 100 years after their original appearances. And just to remind you, here's Hercule Poirot still being filmed, still a familiar name to this current generation. And again, a character almost 100 years old. This is his first introduction to the reading public in Murder on the Orient Express. Murder on the Orient Express by Agatha Christie. Chapter 1. An Important Passenger on the Taurus Express. It was 5 o'clock on a winter's morning in Syria. Alongside the platform at Aleppo stood the train, grandly designed in railway guides as the Taurus Express. It consisted of a kitchen and dining car, a sleeping car, and 2 local coaches. "You have saved us, mon cher," said the general emotionally, to which the stranger, by name Monsieur Hercule Poirot, had made a fitting reply, including the phrase, "But indeed I do not remember that once you saved my life." "Today is Sunday," said Lieutenant Dubosc. "Tomorrow, Monday evening, you will be in Stamboul." "That is so," agreed Monsieur Poirot. "And you intend to remain there a few days, I think?" "Mais oui. Stamboul, it is a city I have never visited. It would be a pity to pass through it, comme ça." Mary Debenham had had little sleep since she left Baghdad on the preceding Thursday. 2 men below her window were talking French. One was a French officer, the other was a little man with enormous moustaches. The wagon-lit conductor had come up to the 2 men. "The train was about to depart," he said. The little man removed his hat. What an egg-shaped head he had. In spite of her preoccupations, Mary Debenham smiled. A ridiculous-looking little man. The sort of little man one could never take seriously. "En voiture, monsieur," said the wagon-lit conductor. "There are not many people travelling, I imagine," Poirot said. Non, monsieur, I have only two other passengers, both English, a colonel from India and a young English lady from Baghdad. She was tall, slim and dark, perhaps 28 years of age. Monsieur Hercule Poirot, having nothing better to do, amused himself by studying her without appearing to do so. She had poise and efficiency. Presently, another person entered the restaurant car. This was a tall man of between 40 and 50, lean of figure, brown of skin, with hair slightly grizzled around the temples. The newcomer gave a little bow to the girl. "Morning, Miss Debenham." "Good morning, Colonel Arbuthnot." The colonel was standing with a hand on the chair opposite. "Any objection?" he asked. "Of course not. Sit down." True to their nationality, the two English people were not chatty. They exchanged a few brief remarks. At lunchtime, the other two again shared a table. Their conversations were more animated than at breakfast. The colonel inquired if she was going straight through to England or if she was stopping in Stamboul. "No, I'm going straight on." "Oh, I see. Well, I may say I'm very glad you are going straight, because I am." The Taurus Express arrived at 7 p.m. at Haydas Passar, near the Strait of the Bosphorus. The Bosphorus was rough and Monsieur Poirot didn't enjoy the crossing. On arrival at the Galata Bridge, he drove straight to the Tocatlian Hotel. At the Tocatlian, Hercule Poirot asked for a room with a bath. Then he stepped over the concierge's desk and inquired for letters. There were three and a telegram. He opened in his usual, neat, unhurried fashion. "Development you predicted in Casnard case has come unexpectedly. Please return immediately."
"Voilà, c'est que embattante," muttered Poirot. "I shall have to leave tonight. At what time does the Simplon Orient leave, monsieur?"
"At 9 o'clock, monsieur. Can you get me a sleeper?"
"Assuredly, monsieur. There is no difficulty this time of year. The trains are almost empty. How far are you going?"
"To London."
"Bien, monsieur. I'll get you a ticket to London and reserve your sleeping car."
"I have time to dine?"
"But assuredly, monsieur."
As he was giving his order to the waiter, a hand was placed on his shoulder.
"Ah, mon vieux," said a voice behind him.
The speaker was a short, elderly man, his hair cut en brosse.
"Monsieur Bouc! Monsieur Poirot!"
Monsieur Bouc was a Belgian, a director of the Compagnie Internationale des Wagons Lits, and his acquaintance with the former star of the Belgian police force dated back many years.
"You return home when?"
"Tonight."
"Splendid! I too! That is to say, I go as far as Lausanne."
"We will meet later," said Monsieur Bouc. Monsieur Poirot addressed himself to the task of keeping his moustaches out of his soup. He was looking at two American people in the restaurant. The younger was a likeable-looking man, but the other, between 60 and 70, produced an unpleasant impression on Poirot.
"I had a curious impression. It was as if a wild animal had passed by me," he told Monsieur Bouc in the lounge.
The concierge came towards them and said, "There is not one first-class sleeping berth."
"Comment?" cried Monsieur Bouc, "at this time of year?"
Well, have no fear, my friend. We will arrange something." Finally, Monsieur Poirot was given a second-class sleeping berth in number 7. He shared the cabin with McQueen. Outside, a voice shouted,
"En voiture!"
The Orient Express had started on its 3-day journey across Europe.
And there you have it. The great Hercule Poirot is introduced to a public that will last generations and is still a famous character today. Perhaps I should have used someone less cosmopolitan than Poirot to illustrate Christie's style, that sort of village murder style that we all know and love. But I like Poirot. Belgians are great, and he still turns up on the telly pretty often. And it's like every generation gives us its own Poirot. And some might say that, sadly, every generation has to suffer through some second-rate version of a Country House murder series on a telly. And this could be, it doesn't matter whether it's Murder, She Wrote, or Midsummer Murders, or bloody Bergerac in the end. Either way, there are always second-class citizens in the world of detective fiction. But Agatha Christie, I think, will always travel first class. Here's a bit more music. Actually, we're going back to 1929 now, with Maurice Chevalier. Or Chevalier, I don't know. My French pronunciation is dreadful. But either way, here he is with a song that I know you're going to enjoy.
Wonderful, Oh, it's wonderful to be in love with you. Beautiful, you're so beautiful. You haunt me all day through. Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Earth in the trees seems to twitter Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise? Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Birds in the trees seem to twitter Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, I love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise? Just to see and hear you, is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise?
From Baldoyle to Beaumont.
Community radio for North East Dublin. 90.3. Near FM.
For issues that affect us all.
For news on human rights around the world.
To keep abreast of global trends.
Tune in to Global Solidarity on Sundays at 4:30.
Shoreheads,
rockers,
hippies
and goths.
We live those teenage years
with the music of the Grove.
Every Friday from 10 to the end with me, Peter Gaynor.
And me, Lynn Kavanagh.
On The Grove Show.
Here on Near FM.
These songs slow down just a little bit.
You holding an event? No advertising budget, but want the community to know all about it? Then why not advertise on Near FM 90.3? Our community event guide is free. We can record a promo for you, or if you'd like to promote the event yourself on air, then we'd be happy to talk to you. Send your event details to events@near.ie or tweet us at @NearFM, or you can post details on our Facebook page. Free local events promotion on the Community Event Guide on Near FM 90.3.
Today, tomorrow, every day.
This is Near FM, community radio for Darndale, Beaumont, Dollymount, Coolock, Artane, Raheny, Kilester, Donnymead, Kilbarrick, Donnycarney, Kilmore, Clontarf, Fairview, part of Near Media Co-op on 90.3 and near.ie, supported by the City of Dublin Education Training Board and Intrio at the Department of Social Protection. Mine, yours, ours.
90.3.
From Ardnagreina to Artane.
Near FM.
Okay, you may have noticed that we slotted in a little advertising break there. Don't worry about that. That just happens every half hour. And we do it because it's a good thing. But anyway, to get back to our mysteries. Oh, I hope you enjoyed Maurice Chevalier before. Every Little Breeze Seems to Whisper Louise. Lovely stuff. 1929. Good Lord. Mystery writers. The current generation of murder mystery writers, detectives, if you like, are having a boom time. Patterson, Deaver, Grisham, Brown, Rendell, Cornwall, and on and on. These guys are ruling the world's airports and train stations, in literary terms, like an occupying army. And yet, despite the fact that these writers are ruling the world in book sale and library terms, library lending, the formula really hasn't changed. It's much the same now as it was when Poe decided to write about a homicidal monkey in the 1840s. And I'm going to give you a prime example here. It's Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. We have that kind of same thing here with the Da Vinci Code as with Agatha Christie and Sherlock Holmes. We have a familiar investigator. And in this case, in Dan Brown's novels, it's Professor Robert Langdon. He's a fictional character created by Brown for his novels Angels and Demons, which came out in 2000, The Da Vinci Code, which came out in 2003, his most famous novel, I think, The Lost Symbol, 2009, I don't even remember that one, to be honest, and Inferno, which came out in 2013, I do remember. Langdon, the character, is a Harvard University professor of, get this, religious iconology and symbology. Symbology is not a real thing. It's just a fictional field. Brown kind of sort of suggests that it's related to the study of historic symbols, but it's really not connected in any real way to any real study, and certainly not the study of semiotics, the study of signs, which is a real field, a real discipline, or academic discipline. Very much like Sherlock Holmes, Langdon can tell, or certainly infer, a lot of information from a very small clue. He could give you a chapter and verse on some long-lost Minoan civilization from an elastic band. He could spot religious mania in a house brick. And as for personal quirkiness, well, he wears a Mickey Mouse watch. What's not to love? You know, you've got to like a guy who's got that kind of sense of personal style. Although Langdon makes his entrance in Angels and Demons in 2000, he really makes it big with the Da Vinci Code, which is a kind of Where's Wally book for grown-ups. There's no mucking about here. There's a little teaser for the reader in every chapter. Each bit starts with a mysterious message written in sign or symbol on a church wall or on the side of a pyramid or, you know, in a building, on a statue, doesn't really matter. And the reader gets about 10 pages of screamingly obvious clues waved in front of the faces. And for any thickies who are too dumb to work it out for themselves, by the end of the chapter, there's the big reveal. Oh my goodness, if you read the gibberish sentence we thought was medieval Arabic backwards, it says, the next clue is in a Scottish graveyard. It's kind of like that. And every little chapter is a self-contained detective novel. It's no wonder it was a bestseller. It's like the sun for detective lovers. And I'm going to give you a taster of it anyway. This is from the prologue of The Da Vinci Code. The great secret is announced, so we know there is a great secret, but it's not actually revealed. But there is a lovely paciness to the style. So here we go. I'm going to read it out for you, and we'll be back in a moment. The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown. Prologue. Renowned curator Jack Saunier staggered through the vaulted archway of the museum's grand gallery. He lunged for the nearest painting he could see, a Caravaggio. Grabbing the gilded frame, the 73-year-old man heaved the masterpiece towards himself until it tore from the wall, and Saunier collapsed backward in a heap beneath the canvas. As he anticipated, a thundering iron gate fell nearby, barricading the entrance to the suite. The parquet floor shook, far off an alarm bell began to ring. The curator lay a moment, gasping for breath, taking stock. I am still alive. He crawled out from under a canvas and scanned the cavernous space for some place to hide. A voice spoke, chillingly close. Do not move. On his hands and knees, the curator froze, turning his head slowly. Only 15 feet away, outside the sealed gate, the mountainous silhouette of his attacker stared through the iron bars. He was broad and tall, with ghost-pale skin and thinning white hair. His irises were pink with dark red pupils. The albino drew a pistol from his coat and aimed the long silencer through the bars directly at the curator. You should not have run. His accent was not easy to place. Now tell me where it is. I told you already, the curator stammered, kneeling defenceless on the floor of the gallery. I have no idea what you are talking about. You are lying. The curator's eyes flew open. The man glanced down at his weapon, looking almost amused. He reached for a second clip, but then seemed to reconsider, smirking calmly at the Sanier's gut. My work here is done. The curator looked down and saw the bullet hole in his white linen shirt. It was framed by a small circle of blood a few inches below his breastbone. For 15 minutes he would survive as his stomach acid seeped into his chest cavity, slowly poisoning him from within. Pain is good, monsieur, the man said. Then he was gone. By the time anyone got to him, Saunier would be dead. Even so, the fear that now gripped him was a fear far greater than that of his own death. I must pass on the secret, he thought. Now that's taken from the prologue there, and after that, every chapter sort of teases us along like a puppy being dragged through the park. I've got a section now from a later chapter where Langdon and his new girlfriend are in a church in London with a soon-to-be sinister new companion. He's sort of friendly at first, but he turns out to be a baddie. Hope that's not spoiled it for anybody. But anyway, it's just a very short little bit here. Examining their clothing, Sophie noted that two of the knights wore tunics over their armour, while the other three, on their gravestones, wore ankle-length robes. Again, utterly unhelpful. Sophie turned her attention to the only other obvious difference, their hand positions. Two knights clutched swords, two prayed, and one had his arms at his sides. After a long moment looking at the hands, Sophie shrugged. Having seen no hint anywhere of a conspicuously absent orb, feeling the weight of the cryptex in her sweater pocket, she glanced back at Langdon and Teabing. The men were moving slowly, still only at the third night, and apparently having no luck either. In no mood to wait, she turned away from them toward the second group of knights, and she crossed the open space. She quietly recited the poem she'd read so many times now that it was committed to memory. In London lies a knight, a pope interred. His labour's fruit a holy wrath incurred. You see the orb that ought to be on his tomb. It speaks of rosy flesh and seeded womb. When Sophie arrived at the second group of knights' tombs, she found that this second group was similar to the first. All lay with varied body positions, wearing armour and swords. That was all except the tenth and final tomb. Hurrying over to it, she stared down. No pillow, no armour, no tunic, no sword. Robert! Lee! She called, her voice echoing around the chamber. There's something missing over here. Both men looked up and immediately began to cross the room towards her. An orb! Teabing called excitedly. His crutches clicked out a rapid staccato as he hurried across the room. Are we missing an orb? Not exactly, Sophie said, frowning at the tenth tube. We seem to be missing an entire night. There's no point blaming me. I didn't write this stuff. But it's still a multi-million copy seller. But when all said and done, it is a fantastic approach to writing a thriller. Get the audience involved. Get them trying to work out the clues as you're going along. It's a good idea, and it certainly worked with Dan Brown, who was unheard of before The Da Vinci Code and is now a multimillionaire. And if you fancy writing a thriller and making millions of euro through international book sales, stay tuned, because after this tune, I'm going to tell you exactly how to do it. And this one is from Mireille and Jean Sablon from 1935, and again, apologies for my pronunciation. Puisque vous partez en voyage, whatever that means. Something about going away on a voyage, I think. But anyway, here we go. Let's see what we get.
C'est gentil de m'avoir accompagné à la gare.
Oh, ben voyons, oui.
Ah, si, si, si. Et puis ces fleurs, ces bonbons, ces journaux.
Savez-vous que c'est la première fois que nous nous séparons depuis que c'est arrivé?
Oh. Remarquez que 15 jours, c'est pas très long.
Alors, évidemment, 15 jours, ça n'est pas très long. Mais songez tout de même à ce que ça fait d'heures, ça. Puisque vous partez en voyage,
puisque nous nous quittons ce soir,
mon cœur fait son apprentissage.
Je veux sourire avec courage.
Voyez, j'ai posé vos bagages. Marche avant, côté du couloir.
Et pour les grands signaux d'usage,
j'ai préparé mon grand mouchoir. Dans un instant, le train démarre.
Vous resterez seul sur le quai.
Et je vous verrai de la gare me dire adieu là-bas avec votre bouquet.
Promettez-moi d'être bien sage, de penser à moi tous les jours.
Et revenez dans notre cage où je guette votre retour. Voilà, je vous ai trouvé une bonne place dans un compartiment où il y a une grosse dame et un vieux curé avec une barbe blanche.
Oh, je crois que je serai très bien.
Et puis je vous ai acheté deux livres.
Ah.
Et voilà le premier, c'est La vie des saintes. Et l'autre, c'est L'imitation de la bienheureuse Ernestine. Ça vous plaît, ça?
Beaucoup.
Puisque vous partez en voyage, vous m'avez promis, ma chérie, de m'écrire 14 pages.
Tous les matins ou davantage.
Pour que je voie votre visage. Baissez la vitre, je vous prie.
C'est affreux, je perds tout courage.
Et moi je déteste Paris.
Le contrôleur crie en voiture.
Le cochon, il sait pourtant bien que je dois rester, mais je jure que s'il le crie encore une fois, moi je viens. J'ai mon amour pour seul bagage. Et tout le reste, je m'en fous. Puisque vous partez en voyage,
mon chéri,
je pars avec vous.
Right, well, you can't argue with that, can you? That was just lovely and old-fashioned and just kind of cute, I think. Anyway, now to the meat of the day's programme. How to write your very own multi-million copy-selling thriller. And I've broken it down into six easy parts for you. Remember these when you're writing, and success is assured. And let's get started. Number one, do not make the all-good hero mistake. Characters are vital. It doesn't matter how good your story idea is, if the characters aren't enjoyable, you might as well forget it. A good character is kind of reasonably well-rounded, not to say perfectly well-balanced and normal. It means fully rounded. A hero who is perfectly good in every way can be a bit dull. Imagine, if you like, Superman without the secret identity. He'd have nothing in the world to worry about. He's invincible, good-looking, and he could cure all the ills of the world with a swish of his sexy cape. Give him a few identity issues, though, and you've got a new story every week. How does he get the girl and keep his super strength a secret and all that stuff? And there's also the kryptonite thing, another weakness. He's got to have flaws as well as virtues. And it's these roiling conflicts that render his survival an open question, that make him interesting. Try not to be boring with your character flaws. At the same time, don't be too outrageous. It would be nice every now and again, just once in a while, to have a hard-boiled detective that doesn't have a drinking problem. On the other hand, you'll find it hard to get people to sympathise with a hero that's a wife-beating, racist shoplifter. Find an inner demon, then work that demon into your hero's backstory, and show how it's affecting him in the present, and could hinder him even further in the future. Give him actions that demonstrate the flaw, and do the same for the rest of your cast. Remember, Robert Langdon has a flaw, and it's not a big deal, but his only real flaw is that he wears a Mickey Mouse watch. It's adorable, but it's a flaw. Work it and be original. Right, I hope you're writing this stuff down, because now it's time for number two. Give the main action some plausible reason for happening. When the hero and the villain come to blows, give them an excuse to do it. Don't just say they've come to blows because it's the end of the book and they need to. And when it comes to the baddie, don't make the exact opposite of the all good hero mistake. Don't make the bad guy all bad and worse, all bad simply because he's a psychopathic nutcase. Most interesting confrontations come from a villain who's kind of justified. The X-Men movies kind of do this all right. The bad guy, Magneto, is pure evil. But again, he's a child survivor of Nazi concentration camps. Of course he's a bit bad. Who wouldn't be? That's characterisation, that is. Hannibal Lecter is pure evil, but he's really clever and sophisticated, and that makes him fascinating. He's also kind of the hero, which sounds odd, but he is bad because he was forced. We don't find this out until about three books after Silence of the Lambs, that he's forced or fooled into eating a bit of his own sister by bad men during the war. And he only kills now and eats impolite people. That's a great backstory, that is. Your villain needs to be as rich in backstory as your hero. We know that Clarice Starling still hears the lambs screaming. But later on we find out that Hannibal still hears his sister screaming. What hopes and dreams does your villain have? And how were they crushed? What made him a villain? And what life-altering hurt did he suffer? Who betrayed him? How did all of this badness affect him over the course of his life? That's how you do a villain. Now, another thing you have to do is the twist. Do the twist, baby! There's nothing like a twist or a shock to keep readers reading. It's part of the fun of reading a thriller. Like, you think the story's going one way, and then you get taken completely by surprise. And I'll give you an example of a way to do this. Just pause after every scene you've written and ask yourself, what does the reader expect to happen next? What do I expect to happen next? And then create a little list of three directions the story might go in. You know, he's going to fall off a cliff, he's going to ride a horse, he's going to find a gun. And then forget all of those and do something completely else. Raymond Chandler, the great hard-boiled detective writer, said, When things slow down, bring in a man with a gun. It doesn't really have to be a man with a gun. It could be anything. It could be a bear runs into the room. The lights go out. A car crashes through the wall. A superhero appears, but he's drunk. A football team start a sing-song. Roy Keane is nice to a journalist. Okay, the last one's a bit stupid, but you get the gist. Just find something sort of original and go for it. And I think I'll just give you one more song, and then I'll give you the last three on this list, so that you will walk away from the programme feeling that you've really, really learned something fabulous.
Sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse. Sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse.
to sorrow. Sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse, sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse tout en rond, les belles dames font comme ça, les messieurs font comme ça, sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse, sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse tout en rond. On y danse tous en rond, toutes les dames font comme ça, les messieurs font comme ça, sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse, sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse tous en rond. On y danse, sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse tous en rond.
There you go, that was Jean Sablon with Sur le pont d'Avignon. And I'd like to make a personal and heartfelt apology to the French nation for my recent and ongoing murder of their lovely language. What could you do? Anyway, to continue, for our budding novelists, a couple of last little points. There's actually only two left. And the most important, I suppose, or certainly right up there in the list, is make your reader feel it. Can you get the reader to experience the emotions of a scene, the emotions that you're feeling when you're writing it, the emotions that you experienced when you were thinking of it? And you might be asking yourself, how do you do this? And the basic way to start is just experience the emotions yourself. Concentrate on recalling an emotional moment in your life, something that hurt you or that excited you, and try and recreate each of those senses in your memory: sight, smell, touch, sound, and keep remembering it until you actually feel that emotion again, and you will. And when you've got it, when you really feel it, then transfer it to the page. It's a bit like method acting. It's that sort of get yourself into the place, be the person that you're writing about. Remember the trauma of dropping an ice cream on a sandy beach during the summer, and how your family and friends laughed, and how you cried and felt terrible about it. Go back to your own childhood, if you have to, and rip those emotions right out of your guts and spill them over the page. Go on there. That's the way to do it. And the last one, I suppose, is communicate. Number five, communicate. What am I talking about? Before there was writing, before people wrote stories and read them, there were storytellers. And the storytellers would tell stories about heroes who went out into the world and confronted monsters and wild animals and demons and massive beasts. And the village, the savage cave-dwelling sort of community, enjoyed these stories. And they were more than just stories to excite them. They were ways of passing on the culture and learning how and when they should fight, how they should act courageously and nobly, and how they should survive. And these first thrillers, if you liked, the message that they carried helped to bring communities together and made society as we know it now. And deep down, the readers of fiction still seek that kind of story and that kind of excitement. So think,
What's your thriller really about? Does it offer hope, or does it end with justice denied? In short, I suppose, what does the reader take away from the book? And what they take away from the book is the theme, or the meaning, or the premise of what you're writing about. You can try to identify the theme of your book. Try and go 20 years into the future and imagine what your character's doing then. Is your character happy and fulfilled, settling down? Is Clarice still hearing the lambs screaming? Or is she happily sort of settled and relaxed in her life? Or is he or she, your hero, 20 years later, a hopeless addict, a homeless person, bored to death with life? What happens when the story ends? That's the lesson that you have provided for your readers, and hopefully that they've learned, and that you've learned in the writing of it. So try and find a way to make clear what the lesson is, and make sure that the book you wrote, the book reads like something that you've written on purpose, rather than just some old tat that you scribbled down in the hope of making a few quid. Think about that and listen to this. They're not connected or anything. It's just a good tune, and I didn't think we could have a French themed show without having, of course, a bit of the dreaded Edith Piaf. And just before we kick off with Edith, I should once again say that if you would like to get in touch with me, you're very welcome to send a mail to bookworm@near.ie, and that's all there is to it. So go for that and enjoy this.
Allez, venez, Milord, vous asseoir à ma table. Il fait si froid dehors, ici c'est confortable. Laissez-vous faire, Milord, et prenez bien vos aises, vos peines sur mon cœur et vos pieds sur une chaise. Je vous connais, Milord, vous ne m'avez jamais vu. Je ne suis qu'une fille du port, une ombre de la rue. Pourtant, je vous ai frôlé quand vous passiez hier. Vous n'étiez pas peu fière, dame, le ciel vous comblait. Votre foulard de soie flottant sur vos épaules, vous aviez le beau rôle, on aurait dit le roi. Vous marchiez en vainqueur au bras d'une demoiselle. Mon Dieu, qu'elle était belle. J'en ai froid dans le cœur. Allez, venez, Milord, vous asseoir à ma table. Il fait si froid dehors, ici c'est confortable. Laissez-vous faire, Milord, et prenez bien vos aises, vos peines sur mon cœur et vos pieds sur une chaise. Je vous connais, Milord, vous ne m'avez